Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in the news, Israel-U.S. makeup, Arizona federal dust-up, and eastern seaboard temperatures way up. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu met with President Obama at the White House. Netanyahu saying what the White House wants to hear.
I want to enter direct talks with the Palestinian leadership now.
The federal government filed suit against Arizona's tough immigration law. Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce is leading the fight against the feds.
They're simply trying to enforce their current policy of no enforcement and amnesty. That's what it's about. They're not worried about profiling. This bill prohibits it.
And 100-degree temps all over the East this week. Here's one very hot New Yorker.
My walls is hot, the beds is hot, it was burning up inside the house.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the spy saga of Arizona facing off with the feds over immigration? BP's soothing talk on the oil. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Eric Bates. Executive editor for Rolling Stone. His magazine has been making waves lately from Afghanistan to the Gulf of Mexico. Eric Bates, welcome.
Good to be here.
And with us from Washington, Matt Continetti, associate editor at the Weekly Standard. Matt, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Eric, and Matt.
So we've got these planes just off the tarmac in Vienna. Wonder what you all think about that. This was yesterday as the spy swap was unfolding. Here's a retired KGB Major General Oleg Kalugin. Really sounds like back in Cold War movies here, saying the two countries will always try to steal each other's secrets.
I think it's just a reminder that the intelligence services are alive and kicking, and they will do so, I mean, irrespective of their public, diplomatic, official relationship.
There's the KGB. Here's former CIA Director James Woolsey saying yesterday he wasn't sure that the Russians planned what the Russians planned to learn when they planted their sleeper agents in American suburbs.
There is also the possibility that the KGB and the Putin regime has gotten so paranoid that they think there really is some inner circle of crafty decision-making in management consulting firms in suburbia.
Matt Continetti, what do you make of this spy swap? 10 Russians back to Russia now. 4 were told others are coming this way on an American plane. What's this all about?
Well, it's about the reset policy of this administration. And the Obama White House came to power wanting to repair relationships with Russia, which they felt had been strained in the second half of the Bush presidency. And to that extent, cosmetically, a lot has improved. The relationship between the president and Russian President Medvedev is very strong. We have the START treaty that has been agreed to by the two countries. It hasn't been approved in the Senate. We have Russian cooperation on some sort of watered-down UN sanctions. But underneath the surface, Russian behavior really hasn't changed. And they still occupy two provinces in Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, since the 2008 war. And, of course, they still have counterintelligence and intelligence assets throughout the world, including, apparently, Anna Chapman in Manhattan and several other Russians throughout the country.
And 9 more. Hillary Clinton in Georgia this week saying this is wrong to have Russians on this soil. Eric Bates, what do you make, though, of the fact there's a reset policy? At the same time, here the U.S. goes pretty hard at a large number of spies in what seem like pretty peripheral locations, as James Woolsey is saying there. What about the timing? How does this figure into reset, Eric?
Well, as Matt said, the Obama administration is really trying to make some headway with Russia in all kinds of new ways. I mean, I just have to say I find the whole thing incredibly comforting. I mean, this is what we used to be terrified of.
Right.
You know, it kind of makes me nostalgic. I mean, compared
to Wall
Street.
Sure beats 9/11 and Wall Street meltdown.
Wall Street and British Petroleum and, yeah. I mean, in Al-Qaeda. It's just, it's like pet rocks and mood rings. It's great. It takes me back.
Jack, are you having a little trip down memory lane with this or something else?
Well, I'd like to see that old iron bridge between East and West Berlin, where the spies used to be exchanged, and you know, you can almost see Smiley on one side and Control on the other, watching the spies meet and the exchange prisoners meet in the middle. You know, I think that the Russia file is the one place where the Obama administration hopes to have a foreign policy achievement. Otherwise, it's pretty barren. So he wants to be able to go to the voters in 2012 saying, I've at least done something abroad other than continue the war in Afghanistan. I think, of course, we're going to talk about Israel, but I think he's hoping that that treaty with Russia, better relations with Russia, that he can point to that as progress.
Well, let's talk about
Israel. And also, how great is it that an American spy is apparently worth 2.5 Russian spies? I mean, now we know the exchange rate now. That's, you know, I feel good about that, too.
Maybe that's the exchange rate when the Russian spies are playing catch in suburban wherever they were.
Could be.
Let's talk about Israel. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in New York on Thursday saying Middle East peace can be achieved despite those who doubt it. And he said that he, with his conservative backers, was the man who could pull it off.
It is when these stereotypes are broken, as in the case of Gorbachev and Reagan, or Nixon and China, or Begin and Sadat, that's when history flows, and it flows in a positive direction. And this is a challenge I'm up to.
Okay. Matthew Continetti. Matt, what do you think? We had this dark of night meeting a couple of months ago when relations were so frosty between the U.S. and Israel. No cameras. The president went off to dinner and left the Israeli prime minister cooling his heels. Didn't stay in the Blair House this time. It's all sort of red carpet, and all the cameras are there. Is there real progress, Matt?
Well, I think there has been some progress in repairing relations between Israel and the United States. Now, whether relations had to be as degraded as they were in March, as you said, when Netanyahu had to enter through the back door, is a whole other question. But I think the White House realized that they had to extend some sort of olive branch to the Israelis. They couldn't have truculent partners on both sides of the issue, especially when there are larger challenges such as Iran at stake as well. So you had this visit. I think it went pretty well. You had President Obama utter the words, the unbreakable bond between the United States and Israel. I think Netanyahu appreciated that. I also think he appreciated the fact that the president had just signed into law some tough sanctions on Iran about refined petroleum and other products that are starting to have an effect, reportedly. So good news on those fronts. And whether we actually get to direct talks now is in the Palestinians' court.
Proximity talks has been the phrase so far. Proximity as in they're not really talking face-to-face. They're just kind of close to one another. Eric Bates, do you really see a breakthrough coming out of this? I mean, there's Netanyahu talking, you know, Nixon to China, but his conservative coalition has put the brakes on a lot here. Do you see enough going forward that the sort of smiling meeting, aura can be maintained?
Well, look, we've all, you know, how long has this been going on in the Middle East? You know, we've seen this so many times only to have it fall apart. It's hard to have much faith in that, but it's a big step in the right direction. You have one of the major partners saying that they're going to do it, and they're going to do it now. It's hard for the other side to have much faith in that when the Israelis are building settlements on top of them. At the same time, they're saying they're willing to negotiate with them. But it's not just on the Palestinians. It's on both sides to step up. One of them is making noises that they're going to, and that's good.
Here's this had the bilateral meeting at the White House. This was on Tuesday. President Obama reaffirming his support for Israel here.
I believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu wants peace. I think he's willing to take risks for peace. And during our conversation, he once again reaffirmed his willingness to engage in serious negotiations with the Palestinians around what I think should be the goal, not just of the two principles involved, but the entire world, and that is two states living side by side in peace and security.
Jack Beatty, lots of sweet talk here, but as we all saw, it was very recently that this relationship was getting about as low as it could go.
Yes, one diplomat quipped that the angry stalemate between these two countries has given way to a cordial stalemate, at least as regards the issue of the of building new housing in Jerusalem. Although I see that some speculate that may have been a deal worked out, that we'll back away from that, from insisting that the moratorium on construction continue, and in return, the Israelis will go for direct talks. Of course, that leaves the Palestinian. We don't know what the response will be from that side. I was impressed reading the Israeli press with the reaction to President Obama's extensive interview with Israeli television. He seemed to go out of his way there to try to reassure Israelis who, if you read the press, it sound like they're close to despair because there is Iran, there is the bomb, there are the justifiable Holocaust fears. Here is a president of the United States, the only country in the world that really supports Israel to this extent, seeming to be tilting toward the Muslim world. The president said, I understand my middle name, Hussein, causes people anxiety. He said, I got into politics as a senator from Illinois, partly thanks to support from the Jewish community. It's very important to me. He tried to show some empathy to the existential security dilemma of Israel, and I think that could really help. Perhaps just in the atmospherics, but perhaps even beyond the atmospherics. The Israelis have got to take enormous risk for peace. And in order to do that, they have to have some reassurance from the United States.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a spy swap with Russia, U.S. versus Arizona on immigration. A federal court calls the ban on gay marriage unconstitutional, and LeBron James goes to Miami. Matt Continetti is with us from the Weekly Standard. Eric Bates is here, executive editor for Rolling Stone magazine. We've got a lot of this Arizona controversy in front of us. Here, let's get a clip of Robert Gibbs defending the lawsuit by the Justice Department against Arizona on its new immigration enforcement law.
You constitutionally cannot have a 50-state patchwork of immigration laws. The only way we're going to solve that is through comprehensive immigration reform. I think we'd all be better served if the 20 Republicans would sit down with Democrats in the House and the Senate, and we could come up with something on comprehensive immigration reform that the President and members of Congress can see acted upon so that we can solve this problem.
Okay, there's the White House looking to sound reasonable, but in Arizona, it didn't look that way, at least not to Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce. He's one of the law sponsors defending his state, Arizona's right to take action on immigration.
This administration is doing everything they can not to enforce the law. And then they sue the Americans, siding with those who break into our country, and President Calderon, who came to our house and criticized our law and our citizens while they ignore the damage and cost in billions and deaths and maimings and jobs taken from Americans. I've never seen anything so upside down in my life. This is the most pathetically written lawsuit.
Jack Beatty, okay, here comes the Justice Department. Arizona's got a tough law, and they say they're just enforcing federal laws that Washington is not enforcing. But here comes the Obama administration.
Here it comes, and the constitutional argument is not on racial discrimination, although it's mentioned in there as a possibility, but rather on the supremacy clause, that the federal government, the Constitution, gives the federal government trump in making law, and especially in the realm of immigration. And they're saying, you know, just on that sheer, you know, constitutional basis, this law must go down. You know, it's interesting to look at Attorney General Holder's brief. He says, if allowed to go into effect, this law's mandatory enforcement scheme will conflict with and undermine the federal government's careful balance of immigration enforcement priorities and objectives. I wonder what careful balance he has in mind. You know, I mean, really, that is the question. There is no careful balance. There's nothing careful at all about our immigration policies. They're in chaos, and Arizona has, I think, wrongly and angrily reacted to them. But it's hard to see a careful balance there at all. I mean, Arizona is going to claim, and it may, I got my law degree at Walmart, so I don't know what the, but they're going to claim that they aren't creating a law that interferes with the federal law, which is the Supremacy Clause rubric, that they are in fact simply enforcing a federal law. So therefore, where's the conflict? We'll have to see.
Matt, you've got the reality at the border, then you've got the Constitution sitting there. Where's right, Matt?
Well, I think Jack's description of the way the two parties are going to be arguing the case is exactly right. You have the Supremacy Clause versus this enforcement issue. And the fact is there is some Supreme Court precedent about this enforcement issue, and that is this case from the 1970s, to talk about back to the future, Deaconess versus Bica. It's a California case, again, and what this is about is, do the states have the right to enforce, to develop their own laws that enforce federal law? Mm-hmm. And the Arizonans, like Russell Pierce, were very aware of this precedent when they wrote their law. They actually took great pains to try to address every concern, including putting in that ban on racial profiling. So I actually think it's likely that the feds may lose this challenge. And of course, another important point aspect of this is that they've already lost in the court of public opinion. Gallup came out with a survey just the other day showing that 56% of the country opposes the federal challenge. So Arizona is definitely on the side of the people in this particular case.
Eric Bates, I want to hear you on that. Let's hear from the people a little bit first. Northfield, Connecticut. Brett, you're on the air, Brett.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd just like to say that I think it's completely abhorrent that the U.S. government is interfering with the states. And I'd also like to say that President Obama ran on a platform for limiting executive power, and he's doing exactly the opposite. And I'll take my answer up here. Thank you.
Okay, Brett, we've got it. Eric Batesman, on the other hand, the federal government has run immigration policy for a long time. How do you see it, Eric?
Well, what's fascinating here to me is the connection with the ruling in Massachusetts overturning the ban on gay marriage. In both cases, the ban on gay marriage and the Arizona immigration law, mm-hmm. you have clearly discriminatory practices. You have civil rights violations. You have people saying, we don't like these other people and we want to stop them on the street or keep them from getting benefits if they try to marry.
Well, clearly to you, there's a big debate about that nationally, right, on both those
cases. But what's interesting is it's not being fought on those grounds. Mm-hmm. It's being fought on states' rights grounds mm-hmm. at a time when we have a president who is the product of an interracial marriage that was illegal in many states right. at the time of his birth
right.
and a president who could only be president through the vigorous passage and enforcement of civil rights laws. So it's just interesting that here we are so many years later with some of the same kinds of issues, but fighting them in the same way we did back then on the states' rights grounds.
We'll come to states' rights on the gay marriage front. Let's get a little more on immigration. Jeff in Charlotte, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm all for the U.S. on this one because, you know, we're all, 98% of us are all immigrants here. And frankly, the jobs that these immigrants are taking are jobs that Americans won't do. You know, picking oranges, milking cows. There's a farm near where I work, and they have Mexicans working there illegally because they can't afford to pay an American to milk cows because they don't get enough for their milk. And so, frankly, you know, make them legal. Make them pay taxes.
Well, I mean, I grew up with dairy farmers, and I didn't see a Mexican among them. At that time, it may have changed now, Jeff, but maybe people would do the jobs, or maybe we'd just pay more for milk and make jobs that way without this labor.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree to pay more for the milk, but, you know, that's not happening. And, frankly, they're going to be here either way, so make them legal. Make them pay taxes. I think I heard it's $13 billion or something in taxes would get annually.
Jack, what do you think of the odds of getting to, I don't know about make them legal, but to some kind of immigration reform here? How do you see the politics of this playing out in, you know, who's taking what position on this case and the bigger issue right now with midterms coming up, Jack?
Well, it seems to be cutting both ways. I see that the four or three Democratic congresspeople in Arizona, they're in trouble. They're trying to distance themselves from this. So it hurts there. In the Colorado governor's race, it's an issue, and it seems to be helping the Republicans there. The Democratic candidate says that he's against this, that he's against the Arizona law. In Texas, on the other hand, it seems to favor the Democrats. The Democratic candidate, Bill White, has a 34-point lead, I read this week, among Hispanic voters, partly since the Arizona law was passed. That was he got a surge then. So it just really is hard to see how it depends upon the state and upon the, you know, the Hispanic vote in that state.
Matt, you may recall who this was. I heard a senior Republican somewhere this week saying, look, we can't make another generational mistake here. We pushed against the Irish, and the Irish were Democrats for three generations. Pushed against the Italians, same there. We cannot do it with Hispanics, Latinos. What about that argument in the GOP, Matt?
Well, I think it's a valid one. I think then the question becomes, well, does enforcing immigration law necessarily mean that you alienate the entire Hispanic population of the United States? I don't think that's necessarily true. I think when you look at Gibbs's comments that we listened to after the break, and when you listen to Democrats say talk about comprehensive reform, blame the Republicans for stopping it, that's just not the case. I mean, the fact is it's Democrats who are very leery about signing on to comprehensive immigration reform, because they understand that right now, at a time of almost 10% unemployment, the American people want an enforcement-first approach. And that's just an approach that this administration and this Congress is not going to embrace. And so I think for the next couple of years, certainly, this issue benefits the Republicans because they're on the side of public opinion. And I've always thought the grand bargain is build the wall and then grant amnesty. But that means that you have to build the wall first. And no one seems very interested in doing that in this White House.
Nicholas in Rochester, Massachusetts. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. What we are doing to these people we call illegal is exploiting them. Let's be honest. If we really want to get rid of them, then the ICE would go into the fields, the orchards, the vineyards. That's where they are. You notice that ICE never raids those places.
The strawberry fields, the tomato patch, yep.
That's right. And if they do that, those people will begin to run. Only then will America realize how much we need them. It is nothing but pure hypocrisy. Thank you, sir.
Nick, thanks for your call. Eric Bates, I mean, we are sitting on a mountain of hypocrisy. At the same time, we've got problems here. I mean, Nick is exactly right. We know who picks what an awful lot of what we eat.
Well, if you want to crack down on it, you don't go into the fields. You go into the slaughterhouses and you bust the employers. And that's the thing that no administration has wanted to do, is take on American business community who are knowingly employing illegal aliens in vast numbers and profiting by the low wages. So, you know, who's the target here and why are they the target? I come back to, again, racial profiling and civil rights violations. The way this is being handled is about some people not liking other people and wanting to do something to them. They feel justified. They feel there's a good reason for it. We can debate that, but it's still discrimination.
One more call on this one, Nashville. Randy, you're on the air.
Well, first of all, I think this is a civil rights issue and that the government is correct in going to court against Phoenix in Arizona. Secondly, the demographics tend to indicate that by 2030, we're not going to have enough workers in the United States. We're going to need Mexican workers, and we're going to need the Mexican economy, which is growing. So I think a far-sighted approach, both legally and democratically, is to allow folks in.
But can we hold our breath until 2030, Randy? We've got almost 10% unemployment here right now.
Well, we're using Mexican workers right now, as has been pointed out many times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're good citizens. I live in an area that has a lot of Hispanic folks in it, and, you know, they're great neighbors.
Randy, I appreciate your call. I want to turn to the other side of this one, as Eric Bates would put it anyway, on the gay marriage front. You've got the federal judge in Massachusetts, Joseph Toro, saying, look, there's a states' rights issue here. The Defense of Marriage Act goes back to the Bill Clinton administration, Defense of Marriage, DOMA. His ruling saying infringes on that right. Jack, how do you read this one? Where are we going? I mean, we're in a kind of stasis for some time here on gay marriage. You know, it seemed to be moving ahead and then sort of stalled out, maybe going back. How does the judge's decision move the debate, Jack?
I don't think it moves it dramatically. At least that seems to be what the early morning commentary is on it. For example, the California case is much more salient. That really does present the issue. Can a state, declare that gay marriage is illegal? That will be
by public vote, and then the court coming back to a rule on that soon.
Right, right. So that's going to be appealed, and that's going to get to the court. On the other hand, Massachusetts, I think we all know that in the future, gay marriage will be the norm. That will just be however long that'll be. That's going to happen. The demography doesn't lie. People, under 30 are just overwhelmingly in favor of this, and it'll happen. And then when it happens, people are going to look back on the original Massachusetts case, which I still think of with and I'm moved when I think of it because it vindicates equal protection of the laws and equal rights, and this case, and they'll say, well, those judges were speaking to the future, just as we look back now on civil rights cases and feel that way about landmark civil rights decisions. So I think that however its immediate effects, the future is clearly with this Massachusetts holding.
Matt, I want to get your view on this case and that view. Here's Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley talking about the decision.
It's exactly the result that we wanted, which was to say the federal government really doesn't have an interest in telling Massachusetts and has never in the past had an ability to dictate how states define marriage.
Matt, what do you say? Of course, Massachusetts has it. How about Jack's depiction of where the future takes this country and marriage?
I think the short-term future is where we're going is to the Supreme Court, and whether it's this particular Massachusetts case gets appealed up there or whether, as Jack mentioned, it's the California case, in which actually Ted Olson, a Republican lawyer, is arguing for on the pro-gay marriage side, whether that gets to the Supreme Court. Olson, of course, a former Solicitor General of the United States in the Bush administration. He would be a good advocate for the pro-same-sex marriage side before the Supreme Court. But I would say that that may be, even if the same-sex marriage proponents win in the Supreme Court, it may be somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory. And let's not forget that whenever the public has an opportunity to vote on this issue, they actually reject gay marriage. And so this could be a Pyrrhic victory if it's won through the courts. If it's won through the democratic process, as Jack suggests, I think that will grant it a greater amount of democratic legitimacy, and that personally is what I would like to see.
We've got another break coming up. Before we get to it, let's hear a little bit of Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal kicking up his heels angrily again this week, saying he's frustrated by the slow government response to the BP oil spill. He wants to drop rocks and block oil. Not everybody in his state is even sure it's a good idea, but here he was this week really upset with the feds on the oil front.
Bottom line, what I'd like the president to do, what I'd like the federal government to do, is to adopt a greater sense of urgency, cut through the red tape, cut through the bureaucracy, and get it done. I really don't care whose fault it is. I don't care if it's Coast Guard, Corps, President, White House, National Incident Commander, Regional Incident Commander. I don't care.
Okay, good, fair enough. Here's Thad Allen, though, the cleanup commander, saying he's optimistic about cleanup, but it's a challenge to coordinate such a big effort.
One of the analogies I've made has been to the militia at Concord before the Revolution. Everybody showed up for the fight. Some had muskets and some had a hatchet. And so our question has been, how do we form these groups up and make them most effective? How do we get skimming capability into their hands? But more importantly, where do we tell them to go? And how do we coordinate how they're doing that?
And, of course, BP saying this week, look to, what is it, July 27 now, when maybe that new pipe they're drilling down there will intersect with the old one and maybe seal this off. We'll come back and look at exactly that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the World Cup's final match is set. Netherlands will play Spain, which won its game to get there in dramatic fashion.
From a corner, and they've got it! It could just be, to this point, the most important goal in Spain's history.
With much hoopla, NBA superstar LeBron James says he will leave Cleveland and join a new dream team in Miami.
This fall, man, this is very tough. And this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Very tough, so tough it took an hour on ESPN to say it, and rioting in the streets of Oakland, California last night after a verdict in the trial of a white former police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black man. We're looking at a week in the news, a spy swap, U.S. versus Arizona on immigration, a federal court calls on gay marriage, LeBron James off to Miami. Let's go right to Kathy in Stamford, Connecticut. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to offer a comment about Bobby Jindal, who seems to be making great use of the oil spill to get himself on TV every fourth day. 2 weeks ago, right after he did one of his "We're not getting any help" press conferences, it was announced that the White House had deployed 6,000 National Guard troops to be available in Louisiana to be put to work. And Jindal said, "Oh, well, we asked for them, but we couldn't get them," and then half an hour later walked that back and said, "Oh, we didn't ask for him." He still hasn't asked for him. And I really feel badly for the people of Louisiana that they have a governor who's more interested in his personal popularity poll than actually getting the spill fixed. And he's real good about blaming everybody else.
Kathy, we've got it. Eric Bates, you guys at Rolling Stone have been writing about the Gulf. What do you make of the politics and the oil reality on the beaches of the Bobby Jindal's, you know, sort of a megaphone here?
Well, we actually broke the story she's referring to, that Jindal, while criticizing the Obama administration, hasn't deployed many of the resources that are available to him, and nor have the governors of the other Gulf states. So they're not really in a position to criticize. The issue is the oil's still coming. There doesn't appear to be any end in sight. It's hard to believe that BP is going to get it fixed by July 27th. But even if they do, that's not going to fix the underlying problem, which is a regulatory system that's broken and that doesn't keep us safe. And that's going to keep going, and that hasn't been addressed yet.
July 27, Jack, BP is saying they hope that this bottom kill drill well that they're putting down to then shoot the drilling mud into the spewing pipe. They hope they intersect by then. I guess I've become pretty skeptical of BP's assertions about how much oil and when and what and what. What do you make of the new timetable? It's sooner than we'd been told earlier. That piece looks good.
Yes, it seems to be timed to the meeting of their stockholders, which is, I think, on that date or right around there. Just a coincidence, I'm sure. And it also seems to be timed to the arrival of David Cameron, the new British Prime Minister, for his first White House visit. Now, maybe it's just the way the technology is working, but I suspect that as we've seen throughout, BP's corporate priorities, which are hard to reconcile with the preservation of the ecology of the Gulf, those priorities seem to have taken the lead place here.
Matt, what do you make of Bobby Jindal's politics? First of all, with his loud protests, does that work for him? Is he mounting up as a GOP presence, do you think? And what about the actual expectation of when we might see an end to this gushing oil?
I think in Jindal's case, his leadership or his crowing or however you want to describe it has helped rehabilitate him in Republican opinion circles about his potential future, which was kind of dashed on the rocks when he delivered the response to President Obama in 2009, the State of the Union that year.
Not real effective there. Mm-hmm.
Right. I hope that BP is right and that they get this well clogged as soon as possible, if it takes to July 27th. I think if they don't make that deadline, I think then we have to start thinking about different options. And one option that has been raised, and I'll throw it out there again, is using demolition, blowing up the well. And it's been raised not only by some experts in this area, but also by former President Bill Clinton. And so I would hope then we turn to more radical solutions if it doesn't work out by the end of this month, because quite frankly, the situation is getting ridiculous. And more to the point, it's going to, no matter when we cap the well or destroy the well, or stop the leak, the crisis is going to continue. It won't be over at that point. You're not only going to have effects in the corporate culture and the future of BP, mm-hmm. but of course the economic effects in the Gulf states as well. So it's better, I think, to stanch the damage, stop the bleeding as soon as possible so that we can go and then deal with the secondary effects of the spill.
Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, listening to your guests, and I'm a little perplexed. And it just seems to be that everybody likes to pile on to BP when, in fact, I think everyone would agree that the entity that has the most to lose here as this oil keeps leaking is BP. They've got more to gain by getting this stopped. And the skepticism by both of your guests that, well, they're not sure of the date. You know, I've done a lot of reading on this, and it appears that every relief well that's ever been tried works.
And let's hope and pray that this one does. But, Mike, I mean, they cut corners in ways that may have led to this in the first place. They vastly underestimated how much oil is coming up into the Gulf. Isn't there reason for skepticism here, Mike?
Well, sure, there's a reason they would underestimate it. As you know, if criminal charges are found or if there's negligence, then the fine is based on the amount of oil going into the Gulf. I mean, wouldn't you underestimate it, too?
Well, you might, but that's hardly reason to then really trust them. It's our Gulf at stake here and everything in it and around it. We need some honesty here, don't we?
Well, I'm not going to compare where we are today to where we've been and to the causes of this. I agree that there were corners cut, apparently, and then we'll know when the investigation
yep.
is over. But they really, I mean, nobody has more incentive to get this stopped than BP, and I think everybody would have to agree with that.
Eric Bates, what about that? Nobody has more incentive to get this stopped than BP, so let's not knock them around so hard.
Well, I don't think either Jack or I in our skepticism are implying that BP doesn't want to get it stopped. I think we're questioning their capacity to get it stopped, which hasn't inspired confidence very much so far. But as I said before, what really needs to be stopped is the kind of recklessness of the oil companies that led to this in the first place, and we don't have a system in place yet to do that, and that's a far greater concern ultimately.
Heather in Boston, you're on the air. Heather.
Hi, Tom. I have a question about the address that President Obama made to the nation a couple of weeks ago regarding the oil spill, where he made the claim that we were going to be capturing 90% of the oil that was escaping yeah. from the broken well. And I'm wondering, you know, where did he get that information, and is there anything that's going to come of that?
Yeah, I wonder the same. It's a good question. Eric, have you all kept track of that? I mean, never mind BP, even from the White House, that sounded good as well, but who knew that for sure? Who can say for sure? I worry there's a kind of feel-good yammer around this gusher that, looking to minimize it, but the reality is just there of the oil coming out. What about that 90% will be stopped by, I forget what the date was. Does that look reasonable?
Yeah, the problem all along has been the administration has been complicit in lowballing the estimate of the problem and not making sure that the company had the resources it needed at hand to deal with the spill. And so it's very hard to trust those kinds of numbers as well. The administration, after Obama gave his Oval Office speech, kind of his mea culpa, approved another 96 leases after the announcement of the moratorium. When we asked them about that, they said they were finalizing paperwork on previous bids. Well, America didn't elect Barack Obama to finalize paperwork, especially not in the aftermath of this catastrophic spill. So we've seen an administration that really hasn't stepped up and taken this as seriously as it should from day one and put the emphasis where it needs to be.
Of course, yesterday, we got this three-judge panel on the U.S. This Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, ruling, turning down the Obama administration's effort to enforce this six-month moratorium on deep-water drilling. We've got a question here from Andrew on Facebook saying, is there really a reason to have a moratorium that punishes all if these other companies that are playing, other companies are playing by the rules? Matt, what do you think of the moratorium and this new ruling, yet another ruling out of New Orleans, where there's a big interest, of course, but is the moratorium going to stand for 6 months?
Oh, I don't believe it will. And I agree with Andrew that I don't see quite the point of it. But I think the administration would argue that you would need 6 months to evaluate the safety in all these rigs. When I read about the BP case, I find that they were, in particular, extremely negligent. I don't think anyone should feel sorry for BP. And so I think the BP's problem shouldn't spill over, so to speak, onto the other oil companies who seem to be complying pretty well and doing this safely. Let's not forget it was 40 years between offshore oil spills.
That's a long time. On the other hand, when oil spills happen, they can ruin awfully big chunks of nature. You know, it took a few million years to make the Gulf of Mexico.
Rare events.
Yeah, and to the extent that the other companies are complying, they're complying with regulations that were gutted by the Bush administration and that, in fact, don't keep us safe, that underestimate the nature of spills, the possibility of spills, that don't provide for the resources to clean up a catastrophic spill should it happen. So the regulations themselves aren't there to keep us safe. Whether anybody's complying with them or not is irrelevant.
I want to look at economic messages or party political messages from a couple of angles here. Obama and maybe Michael Steele for a second. President Obama out on the hustings. Midterms are coming. He's cranking up the rhetoric on the GOP, saying you cannot hand the economy back to those who brought us to this point. Here he was speaking yesterday in Kansas City, Missouri, going after the GOP, saying they can't be trusted to run America's economy again.
They spent nearly a decade driving the economy into the ditch, and now they're asking for the car keys back. They can't have them back. They don't know how to drive.
Jack Beatty, is that going to work? The president's, approval rating's falling again this week, but he's coming out there with a kind of a two-fisted approach. Do you think that's going to sell?
Well, you know, it's not very seemly. I mean, he has been in office, a year and a half plus? To turn around and say it's all their fault, which is what he seems to be saying. On the other hand, he's right, isn't he? I mean, the Wall Street problems, the running off the rail of Wall Street, the Wall Street running into the ditch. That happened under Bush. That happened partly because of the deregulation under both the Democratic and Republican administration. So it's both parties. But at least, you know, that initiating event for this economic catastrophe did happen under the other guys. And I think the last poll I showed that the public still believe that primarily they put the blame for the recession and for the Wall Street behavior that led to it. They put that on the Bush administration. I think that's what the president's trying to do.
Matt, what's the Republican response to this?
Well, the Republican response is we've tried Obama's solutions to this crisis. I mean, an election isn't, you know, a seminar on the causes of the crisis. And I agree with Jack. If it were, then, you know, the Bush administration and their policies deserve a lot of the blame. I think the Clinton administration and its policies deserve even more of the blame. What an election is a vote for which way the country should go forward. And I think the American public has looked at the Obama economic policies and seen that they have not solved what is the number one issue, and that is, no matter which candidate you talk to and which district in the United States, the issue is jobs. And so we had this huge stimulus bill, and we still have unemployment higher than what the administration predicted if the stimulus had passed. So, and it could have been worse is not necessarily the best argument. So I think we're headed toward major Republican successes in November.
Eric Bates, you couldn't blame a voter for saying they don't know which way to turn at this point. You know, GOP policies, Matt says, is not a seminar, but if you look back, everybody's agreeing, had a big role in bringing us here. President Obama's cure so far, and we can debate the reason. We've heard it debated here, Krugman and Ferguson and the rest, but, you know, we don't have low unemployment yet. How do you think it's going to play, Eric?
Well, I think what it was telling is I think Jack inadvertently misspoke. He said that Obama's been in office, I think, 2.5 years. I think that's 1.5.
I meant to say 1.5. I thought
that's
I
did. Right.
Sorry.
But I think,
I did.
But
anyway,
I think
yep.
The fact that none of us even thought about that or blinked at that is an indication of the extent to which it's now Obama's problem. Yeah. And we're starting to see it that way, and voters are starting to see it that way, rightly or wrongly. So we're in a place where it's starting to feel like the Bush administration is a distant past, and if there's an issue at hand, whether it's a big oil disaster or a big Wall Street disaster, that Obama can't stop, you know, can't keep pointing backwards as an excuse.
Talk about legacies. Let's look at another front, the GOP front, a war front for a minute. GOP Chief Michael Steele made some controversial remarks about Afghanistan, just about a week ago now. Spent all week of this week playing defense. He had called the war in Afghanistan President Obama's, quote, war of choice. In Colorado yesterday, he was asked about resigning, but he changed the topic to the fall election.
To the point that you just raised about you know, stepping down. Look, every time something happens, you know, people say, oh, you should step down. Well, the reality of it is that's not happening, so stop the noise on that. Number two, you don't need the distraction. We're focused on winning.
Military involvement in Afghanistan, Steele said, this is not something the U.S. had actively prosecuted or wanted to engage in. Well, I don't know about that. How about his future, Matt?
Well, I think, sadly, Michael Steele is right. He ain't going anywhere, as he said yesterday to another reporter. And, of course, in that clip that you played shows the reality of Michael Steele's Republican chair. He said every time something like this happens, there are calls for his resignation. Well, that's the point. This happens every time. It seems like there's not a moment when Michael Steele hasn't said something that's embarrassing or causes controversy. And so if Republicans win big this November, as I think they will, they're on track to, it's not going to be because of Michael Steele. It's going to be despite him.
Of course, he argues it just the other way. Look where we are. We're poised for some successes here. Get off my back.
Correlation is not causation.
Indeed. Philosophy 101. Eric, where do you see the GOP going with Michael Steele?
Well, I think Michael Steele's not going anywhere. I think if they do succeed in getting rid of him, based on that speech, he might be able to get a job at MoveOn.
Hey, and what about Afghanistan? You guys made a lot of noise, got a general kicked out with your piece. It's drawn some darts of its own, but is he right? Is this Obama's war, Eric?
It has become Obama's war, and that was one of the broader points of our piece, which is that McChrystal aside, you've got a policy that's not working and that Obama had campaigned against and is now pursuing.
Jack, off goes McChrystal, in comes Petraeus, and Afghanistan, well, long way from a solution this week for President Obama. Anybody else?
It certainly is, although I heard General Petraeus seems confident. He used the verb win this week. Haven't heard that in a long time.
No, we haven't. There you go, win. Well, it's a word. We'll see what happens on the ground. Matt Continetti with the Weekly Standard, thank you very much for being with us today. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
Eric Bates, executive editor at Rolling Stone. You guys are on a roll. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Good to be here, Tom.
Jack, have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.